Good evening. My name is Rachel, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Adam, I didn't know we have so much in common. I'm so glad I got to hear you tonight. Okay. My sobriety date is 8/28 of 2003. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I sponsor other women. I have a home group. It's the Monday Night Speakers Group in St. Petersburg, Florida. We meet Monday nights at 8 p.m. We're a hybrid meeting, and we are a pocket of enthusiasm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I do believe that. And I love that group, and it's, you know, survived the pandemic, and it's adjusted to with the hybrid meeting, and I love it. So I get really nervous when I talk. This is my least favorite service work to do. And I called my sponsor yesterday and I told her, you know, I'm asked to speak like 4 different times and da-da-da, and it's really stressing me out, and why would people ask a pregnant woman to speak? And then I was reminded from one of my sponsees that when she was 7 months pregnant, she told me she really just didn't feel like she could do it. And I was like, we show up for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't care how you're feeling. But I just had no idea. So I'm sorry about that. And I have this sweating disorder. It's called hyperhidrosis. It's real. My hands and feet sweat uncontrollably when I'm in stressful situations. Not even like life and death situations, they don't get this bad. Just really public speaking. So I was born and raised in Miami-Dade County to 2 loving and wonderful parents who tried for a long time to have me. And they had my sister really close after me. We're only 16 months apart. I believe that I was born with this thing. You know, some of my earliest memories are just feeling very out of place, super awkward, like all the kids on the playground had gotten this memo that I had no idea. I hadn't read the memo. They all knew like what their favorite colors were and dinosaurs and things to say. Oh, thank you so much. And I just, I felt less than and not a part of from my very earliest memories. And I was teased, you know, I was bullied a lot. I was a pretty overweight as a kid, and my parents thought it was an amazing idea to put braces on me in like the first grade. And I had these Coke bottle glasses, and you know, I had my sweating disorder was even worse, you know, back then. And so I just, you know, my husband was like really well adjusted, had lots of friends, like that just, you know, wasn't my story growing up. And I started being sexually abused when I was about 10 years old. I had begged my parents. My parents are, I don't want to call them atheists. I'll call them agnostic. You know, they celebrate the commercial holidays of Xmas and like Easter Bunny with the bunny. But not like go to church ever. They both had bad experiences growing up, and so kind of turned away and didn't want either my sister or I to grow up with that. And so I would beg to go to this church down the street from my house with, you know, the next door neighbor, and I begged and begged, and I finally went. And this 18-year-old guy took an interest in me, and he was really, I thought, really cute, right? He would take me out to his car, and the things that I would do in that car, you know, I just felt disgusting. And I knew if my peers knew the things that I had done, that they would also think I was disgusting. And for me, it just confirmed what I already knew. You know, something was inherently wrong with me. And that doesn't make me alcoholic, but I know a lot of people in here come in with those things that they're never going to talk about. And so I was really ready for that first drink. My first drink, although I had other, you know, I had like an obsession with Dimetapp from a very young age, and also would like sneak into this cabinet and sip on Scope because I thought it was refreshing. I don't remember it giving me like an effect, but I just did things like that. And so my first drink, though, of alcohol, I was I was 11 years old, almost 12, going into my sixth grade year, and this cooler girl in the neighborhood was like, oh, we're going to go walk to this trailer park and get this guy to buy us alcohol. And I was like, awesome, you know, I do that all the time, right? And so we go, and this guy in the trailer park, Wolfman, bought us alcohol, and he didn't make us do any sexual favors, which I would come to learn was very nice of him. And I got MD 2020 the orange, and I just intuitively knew that you were supposed to chug this MD 2020 as fast as you could, you know, and I got insanely drunk, and what drinking did for me that day was it gave me a spiritual experience. You know, that's the only way I can put it into words now. I was inwardly reorganized. You know, I didn't care about my sweating disorder. I wasn't as socially awkward. And I knew how to hold my hands when I was talking. And I could even talk to, you know, I could talk to guys and it was okay, you know. And it did everything for me that Alcoholics Anonymous does for me today. But in an instant. You know, my favorite speaker, Norm Alpe, he talks about getting downtown and getting there right now, you know. Boom, downtown, you're there. You're like one step above like consciousness, which is where I would like to hang out, but it's very hard to achieve. And so he talks about getting downtown right now, and Alcoholics Anonymous does the same exact thing, except you have to do these things that as an alcoholic, I hate, you know, like be disciplined, have consistency, and be honest, really work on yourself. And but I get that same effect produced by alcohol in these rooms. If I didn't, I promise you guys, I still wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here. So yeah, my drinking, I pretty much sucked at it. Kind of goes downhill from like the age of 13. I started getting in trouble and appearing in juvenile detention centers. Could not graduate. I was in all those diversion programs. Could not graduate any of them because I couldn't pass a drug test. And I thought that made me really cool, you know. And my poor parents, you know, they really, really tried. They put me in front of every psychiatrist, psychologist, took me in and out to special, like specialty schools, and even got me a tutor. So I took off a whole year of school, but could still get credit for that year. They just really catered. And, you know, I got diagnosed with all of those oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorder and all the things that are like the predecessors to like bipolar and schizophrenia, right? And, just because I was so intoxicated all the time that they couldn't tell what was going on with me. But these diagnoses, they were perfect for me. You know, just tell me what's wrong with me. Tell me what I am so I can look it up and just be that. And it really became my identity, you know. And so by the time I was in my first outpatient when I was 13, I started coming around you guys about 13, 14 years old. And I remember I would sit in these meetings and it would be filled with smoke. It was the 90s. It was amazing. You could smoke in like every meeting. And people would come up to me and tell me they spilled more than I ever drank, which they had, and that I was really cute, which I was. And, you know, and but I would relate on this like deep guttural level to these people talking about their alcoholism. You know, I'm 14 years old, and I would shake my head when they were talking, and I was like, God, I know I have what they have, but how is that possible? I'm 14, and they're like losers. They're like literally 34, you know? Like, they have to come here. What else do they have to do? And you know, I just continued to get in trouble, continued to get arrested. The end, you know, for me of being in, I grew up in Miami-Dade County, I don't know if I said that, which I also really related to Adam saying, Dade County was just a hard place for me to be in early sobriety. And I'm so grateful. You went to New Orleans, you know, I was in Jackson, Mississippi, which is not that far. It's about a 3-hour drive. And I just needed to be in a different place. And that's not true for everybody, but for me, it definitely helped to remove me out of that environment that I had entangled myself into. And so right before I'd gotten let back into the school for my senior year, like a real high school, not a pretend like my parents pay for the diploma type school. And they were going to let me graduate from this school, and it was literally a miracle. I was so intoxicated on my graduation day. I could not let my parents have that moment. You know, I couldn't even graduate drug court, and they're so excited that their daughter's graduating high school. And I just could not let them have that moment. And I really, I embarrassed them on that day, and I know that. And then I ended up going to a hotel party in Collier County, which I don't know why we decided to go out there, but that's where we were. And we were asked to leave the hotel, which sounds right. And you know, I always had Javier drive for me because I could not drive. I really sucked at driving. I created 6-car pileups on US-1 when I drove drunk, and never got a DUI, which is insane. But I was passenger side when Javier got 3 DUIs. And so we were in Collier County. I was definitely too intoxicated to drive. Javier drove home from Marco Island, and we both passed out in the car and fell into a 25-foot ditch right off of Alligator Alley and ripped the bottom out of my little Volkswagen Beetle. And, you know, the police pulled off the road to see if we were okay. I didn't want to talk to them. I apparently assaulted one of them and ended up having my stomach pumped in the back of an EMS vehicle and came to in general population of Collier County Women's Facility because they were doing like some sort of a scared straight thing with me. Javi got to stay in holding, but I was with these girls. And when I came to, you guys, I had arrived. You know, these girls thought I was crazy and they thought I was funny. So I was cool. And I loved every minute of it, you know. And they took these Skittles and put them on my lips. They took a pencil and put it under my eyes. And they told me later we could get pills. And I thought, who would ever leave this place? It's perfect. And I felt like they were all my best friends. Then my parents came to get me the next day. And I was like, I can't leave, you know. I love it here. And It was ridiculous, you know. So that night, I sold a car, picked up Javier, my mom's car, because my car was totaled, and went on a high-speed, got into a high-speed chase over some stuff with these other guys, and got off I-95 really fast, got off the ramp, went into a light pole, the light pole fell on the car, and the police were right behind us, you know, and I went back to jail. You know, and that was my third arrest after the age of 18. So my attorney started saying things like mandatory yada yada things, and I remember being so entitled and thinking, look, like girls like me, we don't go to prison, you know, like that's not my story, like that's not what's about to happen. And and they would just look at me like I was insane, you know. And I went to a treatment center, and I got court ordered into treatment for 1 year, which was very nice. But at the time, I thought my life was over. You know, I wasn't going to start my first year of college. So I, you know, I'm in this treatment center in Miami. I'm not following any of the rules. There's Spanish guys. There's like this whole Spanish program as part of my program. So I'm just sleeping with all the Spanish guys and from like Ecuador and Colombia. And then, you know, they kicked me out because you're not allowed to do that. And I got put in an all women's facility in Jackson, outside of Jackson, Mississippi. At the time, I was the youngest person to ever get admitted into there. That was like my badge of honor. That was the greatest thing. I was like, that is so, I'm so cool, right? And So, you know, I'm in an all-women's facility, so I just start sleeping with the women, you know. And then I think that I've been sexually confused this whole time, and I must know my core issue. It's probably that I'm a lesbian, you know. And I just was not going to talk about my abuse. I was definitely not going to talk about my relationship with alcohol because it was my solution. I would talk about the other substances that I engaged in as a problem, and yeah, I really see that I can't do those again, but this drinking thing, you guys are really overreacting, and it's just making me very upset. And so I overheard the treatment team one day talk about this guy. He was toxic to the therapeutic community. He was going to be on blackout. And so I got a note over a moat because as a female alcoholic, we are extremely resourceful and we don't quit. We find a way. And I got this note over a moat, and we snuck out at about 1 or 2 in the morning, and we met. He was everything I thought he would be, you know, and amazing. And I was in love instantly, you know, that like intense rehab love. If none of you have ever experienced that before, it's amazing. And it's amazing. And I work in treatment now, and like they'll tell me, you know, oh, and so-and-so, and I really like I'm getting feelings for so-and-so, and I want to be like, oh, I get it. But I have to be like, look, like you just can't do that while you're here, you know, and just can't do that. So we leave AMA together, which was a great decision because I was almost 8 months into my treatment at that point. I only had like 4 months to complete, so my attorney had to go and do all of this stuff and make my life way more complicated. And I thought because he was from nowhere, Mississippi, and I was from Miami, that he wasn't as like street smart as me. And I just started to see and do things that I had been very sheltered from because of Javier and because of the friends that I had in my life that would keep me out of those kinds of scrapes. And I started to frequent bars that would serve minors, like Sam's Lounge in Jackson, Mississippi, that's connected to a motel. You guys know the kind of stuff that goes on there. And I started to sell myself piece by piece for that next drink. You know, to the point where I wouldn't recognize myself when I would catch my eyes in the mirror, and where I felt like I was just living every day like an animal. You know, it was so hard for me to get to work. I had this job. My parents started going to this really annoying thing called Al-Anon. I would call them, you know, asking for money, and they would tell me that they were detaching from me with love. And I'd be like, I am your daughter. Like, what are you doing? And thank God they did, you know, because I finally hit my bottom that way. And so one of the issues I brought in here with me is that I think I'm entitled to men's money, right? So I had this guy, Larry, who would give me money, get my hair done, get my nails done, get tan, blah, blah, blah. And you know, the necessities. And he fell on hard times. I had met him through the treatment center that I had been in. And I moved him into our apartment. So it was just the three of us in one big, happy, dysfunctional family. And Larry would say really morbid stuff, you know, and I was really worried about him. I was trying to get him into a treatment center. And it was with him that I started drinking in the mornings, you know, that I would go and get this glass bottle of vodka out of the freezer, and I would pour it, and I would just, you know, wait for it to hit me in the morning so that I could go, you know, so that I could go to work, so that I could try to leave the apartment. And it was really, really dark. It was really, really dark. And so Larry ended up shooting and killing himself one day after we got into an argument. And I opened his door, and I found him dead. And when I saw his face and, like, the peace that had come over him, I was jealous. You know, I looked at him, and I was like, lucky. because I knew that he had what I had, this committee up here that just does not stop telling me how, what a piece of crap I am, you know, and how I'm never going to measure up and how it's never going to be okay and how I'm good for nothing and I'm good for one thing and I'm not even good for that, you know? And I had gotten into college around that time, like, well, back in January, so it's August 11th at this point, and I had told the boyfriend who cared about my hopes and dreams, not at all, that I really needed to go to college and I needed to stop drinking, you know, that I really felt like it was getting really dark for me, that I was in a bad place. And, you know, we went out the night before I was supposed to start college, and I didn't make it. You know, I didn't make it to class that next day. In fact, I didn't make it to class the next 3 days, but I was right on time. Because my God, he is always right on time. So on August 27th, 2003, I walked into an American government class. Supposedly I'm from Miami. I mean, I'm from America, but I mean, I am from Miami. So I didn't know anything that was going on. And I felt like my brain was crackling and sizzling, and I was comparing my insides with these like painfully normal kids from Alabama and Louisiana, and they had the side swoop with the hair and they had the glass. I mean, they just were like these Abercrombie perfect looking kids. And I knew that, you know, they didn't have to sleep with their keys in their socks or hide, you know, anything of value under a mattress when they went to sleep, you know. And some girl raised her hand in the class and she said, "Dr. Grummel, what's your favorite kind of wine?" And he said, "I don't drink. I'm allergic to alcohol." And that's all I heard that whole class. So I went up to him after the class and I said, "You know, I'm going to need extra help. I've been out of school about 18 months. And by the way, how allergic to alcohol are you?" And he put down a 14-year medallion. He did not miss a beat. He took one look at me and he sized me up pretty, you know, he sized me up accurately. And he put down a 14-year medallion and he told me that he had gotten sober when he was 19. And I was in the last week of my 19, like of being 19 before my 20th birthday. And he asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he took me to the Way Out group in Jackson, Mississippi. I'd been to that meeting before. I'd picked up white chips before. I was kind of pathetic, you know, in AA, that kind of, the person that you clap for, like, yay, they got another white chip. You know, I was one of those, and I wouldn't get women's numbers. I didn't want to, like, hang out. I didn't want to do any of that stuff, right? So on that night, I picked up a white chip. I made my sobriety date August 28th because I'd been drinking that whole day. And, you know, that was 18 years ago, and I have not done much right in here, especially in my first 10 years. So if you're not living right and you're under 10 years, it's okay. You can push through. You know, my parents did not trust me, and maybe I would say they trust me today. But, you know, my first 5 years, I would visit. I was not allowed, you know, if I was in the house, they would not leave the house. They were very nervous with me there. I was not allowed to operate any of their cars. You know, like per the insurance company, I was not allowed to operate any of their cars. So I had curfew, you know, 11 o'clock. I was not allowed to have a key to their home. And, you know, and Alcoholics Anonymous transformed that relationship for me. Transformed. And it didn't happen as fast as I wanted it to. And I would get super resentful and angry because I thought I deserved a parade for having 5 years sober at 24 years old. And, but slowly but surely, you know, that relationship was restored. And things happened for me, like when I didn't get into graduate school in, or didn't get into nursing school in Tampa and only got in Miami, they opened their home to me, you know, and they let me live there with them not there. and I would let their realtor in because they were trying to sell their house, and I got to be there for them and show up there for them. While I was drinking, when my grandfather went into cardiac arrest and they decided to take him off life support, I was about 16 years old at the time. I had run away for about 3 or 4 days, and my parents couldn't find me. And my mom's father is dying, so she has to leave to North Carolina. And she and my sister went without my dad and I because my dad was stuck looking for me in Miami. He finally found me, and we drove instead of flew. It was a very long 13-hour ride because I was inebriated, you know. And then I met up with some cousins before my grandfather's funeral. And my family's from the Appalachian Mountains of North Carolina, so we drank moonshine. And I got so sick at that funeral. Instead of my mom grieving her father, she was holding my head over a toilet, putting ice on the side of my face, you know, taking care of me because I was so sick. And then, you know, when I was sober, my grandmother was dying, and I got to be completely different. I got to show up at her bedside. I got to paint her nails. I got to brush her hair. I got to take her to the bathroom. I got to honor her. I got to speak at her funeral, you know, and I got to honor my mom and her love for her mom. And a little piece of myself got to come back, you know. And one of the things that really had evaded me was forming a partnership with another person. I was a serial monogamist in here. Every 2.5, 3 years, maybe 3 years, I would be with someone else, but it would be long term and it would be forever, you know? And I had really tumultuous, toxic relationships, you know? And when I was 6 years in one of those toxic relationships, I was being, you know, I always got broken up with. And my partner came home and told me that they had been cheating on me and they didn't want to be with me anymore. That's when I was living in New Orleans. And I assaulted them. And I went home to, instead of being Baker acted, my parents were like, okay, so you can come and stay with us and like get it together. And I was so devastated in that moment that I tried to hurt myself, you know. And that's all I had at, like, those were my coping skills at 6 years sober. Fast forward, you know, I get into another really toxic relationship. It moves me to Sarasota because I always chase them, right? And it ends, though. I mean, I would be working with girls at the Salvation Army, and they would tell me they knew the person I was dating, and I'd be like, oh, how so? They'd be like, oh, he gives me, like, you know, $40 for sexual favors. I'd be like, oh, you don't say. Awesome. And so, you know, and he broke up with me, you guys, I was begging to stay with him, begging, like throwing myself on his car and in his front yard to stay with him. But when he finally ended it, which was the most selfless thing he ever did for me, I only stalked him like 5 times, and I didn't try to hurt myself or take my life. You know, I did think about drinking. But I was in the middle, you know, I was in the middle, and I had sponsees, and I had a program moving, and I had, insurance that I wasn't going to pick up that next drink if I just had smart feet and stayed in the middle. And my sponsor would tell me, you know, you attract who you are. You attract who you are. So if you want someone who loves Alcoholics Anonymous and loves God and is as passionate about recovery, you have to show up that way. You have to be that to attract that. And you guys, if that's at all true, I got a really loving and gentle man, you know, in my life today. And I know what it is to be a partner. I never knew, you know. And we had a sober wedding, and it was beautiful. And I'll close with this last story. You know, we had been trying to get pregnant for about 3 years. I was getting really disenchanted with the whole process. You know, I felt like if God wanted me to have a baby, he would. You know, he was just going to give it to me. He's going to let me do this. And this girl who I didn't even think liked me, because I think everyone literally hates me, she reached out to me because she had heard that I was struggling, you know, with miscarriages and getting pregnant. And she encouraged me to go to the fertility specialist, you know. And I was like, okay, finally, okay. And once I did that, you know, it was within that year that, you know, we got pregnant. And it's like all of these blessings, all of these things, they're such like minuscule things. They're just life on life's terms type things, but they're everything. They're just everything. And I could have missed it all if not for you guys. Thank you so much.